Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 492. In this episode, Scott talks with Abby Covert about information architecture.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm talking with Abby Covert. She's an information architect and the president of the Information Architect Institute. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
So I know about software architecture, and I know about building architecture, but what is information architecture?
Well, if you know about software architecture and building architecture, then you're part of the way there already. Information architecture is the way that we arrange the parts of something to make it more understandable as a whole. So you might think about that in terms of software. It would be deciding the way that we divide the screens or states or menus into language that is easily understandable by our users. If you're thinking about a book, it would be the way that we've divided the pages, chapters, the indexing methodology we've chosen. So whatever the pieces are for the particular material that you're working in.
Is this a part of information science? Is this like library science?
Information architecture is actually really related to a lot of different disciplines, which I think actually highlights how important it is to sort of humanness. Library science being one of them, graphic design being another, software architecture being another. Also, you see it in kind of fields like content strategy, user experience. So library science happens to be one of the ones that information architecture has quite a healthy home in.
Mm-hmm. Is it like I know about the Dewey Decimal System was a big deal when I was like growing up and they would explain that. Is it classification? Is that a subfield?
Classification is a big part of information architecture work, but I would say that the understanding of language and structure in general is sort of the more zoomed out perspective on what it is as a whole. So it's not just the way you classify things. It's also the way that you organize them in other vicinities as well, from the menus that you describe, the labels that you choose, and also just the object definitions that might go into the description of a product or service.
You know, it's funny that you say the object definitions, because I've always, when I started in software, I started in object-oriented software, and one of the first things that they teach us is that it's really hard to name things, but if you really, really put the work into naming them and organizing them well, something will click, and then things will kind of open up in front of you. So sometimes we'd sit around trying to name an object, and people would say, why are we doing this? This is a waste of time. We're spending too much time trying to name this. And the main architect would say, no, if we get this part right, then everything else will hang off of it.
Yeah, and the more people that you get into that room having that conversation about language, it turns out the harder that it is. So if you're working in a team of one and you're trying to define objects, it's hard enough to give things names. But when you get into large corporations and you try to define object names across departments and across, you know, billing centers and all these other things, it turns out that it can be quite complex. And I do hear from people a lot like, oh, that's just a semantic argument. And I'm like, yeah, it's just a semantic argument. It's like one of the most important arguments you can have. So, it's pretty interesting to work with companies on their information architecture. Lots and lots of arguing.
So you said just twice. I said just. Why do people just want to put things in a box like that? Is this a way of us classifying information that we're receiving?
Oh man, I think we could go pretty deep on philosophy at that point. I think that people are not necessarily comfortable with the lack of true objectivity in the world. I mean, we want to believe that there is one right way, one wrong way, one word that is correct for whatever we're talking about. And often what we're actually talking about is what is correct in our brains. So our mental models and the language that we've structured in our own kind of brain affects us quite deeply in terms of the way that we accept other people's version of the world. So yeah, I think that it is just as an interesting word. It's one of the most evil words that you can use to describe what somebody else is doing, especially for a living, I think.
Yeah, it's such a diminutive. I mean, it's just you've taken your entire life's work, you know, and you're chatting with someone at a cocktail party and it's like, oh, that's just categorizing stuff. Thank you for...
Yeah, it's just categorizing stuff, guys. No bigs.
You mentioned, I think, design there for a moment. There's a lot of people talking about UX. Like, as two-letter acronyms go, UX seems to be the hot one, and everyone just, a lot of people, let's just be real, have jumped into, you know, user experience and declared themselves user experience experts. Their qualifications might be a design degree or work in this field. Their qualifications might also just be that they're really empathetic. Why do you think that UX has kind of captured the imagination, while IA, you know, maybe hasn't as much?
It's interesting, actually. If you go through and look sort of historically at the rise of the acronym UX and the rise of that as a job title in general, it has a very close relationship with IA. Many of the people who have been working in what's now called UX for more than about 7 years used to have a job title that was either web designer or information architect. And one of the sort of ruptures that happened really early in that history was a discussion that began about something called big IA versus little IA. And little IA is the classification of things at the smallest level. So, you know, deciding a meta tag sequence, discussing the metadata attributes that are going to be on a particular object, taking an existing taxonomy and classifying existing documents according to it. So very much more in the librarianship kind of vicinity. But big IA was this idea that you were strategically thinking about language and structure. And I think that a lot of people in the information architecture industry got really into this idea of big IA as sort of our future and how we could get a seat at the business and design tables that we're starting to set up in companies and consultancies and agencies. So over time, there was, you know, kind of this belief set that users were really the differentiator that we were bringing, because other people knew how to talk about words and structures, but we were the ones saying, oh, you should be testing these with users. You should be doing research strategically into what to call things and how to structure things. So user experience was really very much emergent from that school of thought. And many of the leaders in the UX field actually were information architects to start.
Interesting. I seem to remember an article, I'm dating myself here, somewhere in the early 2000s, where a designer named Jesse James Garrett talked about big IA and little IA. He was a user experience person and a designer and an IA fan.
Still is. Yeah, Jesse's great. He actually gave a keynote presentation at the Information Architecture Summit in 2009, which is sort of, I guess, considered by many to be the moment that we changed from IA to UX. And there was definitely an earthquake of movement after that. People standing up and saying, I'm going to change the name of academic programs. I'm going to change the name of my company. I'm going to change the offerings that we have at our agency. And he's sort of famous for saying, there's no such thing as an information architect or an interaction designer. We have always been and will always be user experience designers. So that was the wave that began much of what's been going on for, you know, the last decade.
And for the techies that are listening, just as an aside and as a point of note, Jesse James Garrett also happened to be the individual who coined the word AJAX to refer to some of the ways that we do things with JavaScript today.
Yep.
So you said that that was a change towards UX, but why am I having you on the show as an information architect? And why is there an information architect institute, and why are you an IA person? Was it a split, or was it a refinement of a particular aspect of information architecture?
So I think that was about the time that we all started to consider the effect of generalists versus specialists. And some of us went off to become very comfortable as generalists and wanted to learn as much underneath the user experience umbrella as possible. So learning to do usability tests, learning to do interaction design, learning to code so you could build your own interactive prototypes, kind of the whole kit and caboodle. Some of us, myself included, have instead decided to specialize. And by specializing, we tend to work on the larger projects that are specialized in general. So I don't work on projects that don't have user experience people. It's just that the user experience people that I work with understand that when it comes to semantic arguing, they would like an expert to come in to facilitate that conversation.
Is it hard to sell oneself as an expert, or to even sell the concept of something as initially vague as information architecture to someone who isn't immediately familiar with the term?
Absolutely. It's interesting because it's simultaneously hard to explain and impossible for strangers to not be able to explain to me. So if I ask a cab driver, like, what do you think information architecture is? They almost always can come to their own definition that's pretty darn close just by thinking it out, right? But for whatever reason, I think that there is a lot of stigma around selling specialty in a world of generalism. You know, like, we've been talking a lot as an industry about concepts like being a design unicorn, and designers should code, and, you know, everyone should be testing. And all of those things, I think, are true in the right context. And as an information architect, I still do prototype. I still do talk to users. It's just at a different level. My understanding of those things is always directly related to structure and language, as opposed to interfaces, which you see people on the interaction design side go to.
So to see if I understood the big IA, little IA debate correctly, then little IA, the more narrow view, is applying concepts of information science to web design, web application development, things like classification and, you know, pulling information. And then big IA is a bigger tent that includes UX and usability and all of those things as it relates to the design.
I would say that big IA is the consideration strategically about what things should be called and how things should be structured. So, for example, I recently worked with a company that was a mid-sized startup that had recently acquired two other mid-sized startups, right? So all of a sudden they had three languages that were on the table across the 250 people that all of a sudden worked under this one company name. And they had all these applications that slowly over time have to be migrated towards a consistent vocabulary. Otherwise, they're going to, you know, have all sorts of efficiency problems, as well as communication problems with their customer service staff, their customers, you know, the marketing departments, everything. So when it comes to a task like that, little IA would be listening to the direction of what's been decided and helping the team to reclassify things on a piece-by-piece basis and saying, okay, well, this is going to get called this, this is going to get called that. Big IA is having the very difficult conversations at the top level of an organization to get them to even understand that a single vocabulary is necessary, and then going through all of the vocabularies that might exist, trying to get to, okay, what's the right way forward? What's the directionality that we should actually be taking as a group?
Okay, so then with little IA, you could have been brought in by some middle manager to work on a project, and big IA is going to have you having a conversation with the CIO and maybe the CEO about why this could be huge for the whole company. Ah, okay. And I remember a couple of years ago, you were having a chat with me and selling me on IA before. And what popped for me was a story you had about reorganizing a menu for a large food company. Would you mind telling me that story again? Because it all snapped together for me that day.
Sure. Yeah, I worked for a large fast food restaurant chain a couple years back. And the big problem statement that they had was that even though the name of the food that they are most famous for is in their name, people were asking their staff over and over again, what should I order here? It had completely gotten lost in sort of the cruft of their menu system. And I'm not talking about their online menu. I'm talking about like the paper menu that's laminated you know, in the restaurant itself. And when we looked at it, what we found was that because they had a focus on that item had become kind of watered down over time. And with franchisees and different stakeholders and different agencies getting involved to run things like campaigns for different holiday seasons, et cetera, they kind of lost their way. So I helped them to reduce their menu by about 40%. And we also reorganized it from a taxonomy standpoint and kind of messed with the labeling system and the way that users would interact with that menu to focus on that core item, but then also focus on the idea of adding sides. And the result was a 4% increase of sales in the stores that implemented that menu just in the first year alone. So it was a really great case study for me to just understand that the information architecture work that I do isn't just applied in the digital world. It's actually quite applicable in things like print design.
Mm-hmm. And this was like absolutely measurable. This isn't statistically insignificant. This isn't a small thing. Like corporate says, when this new change has been made, measurable fundamental change in our company, our business, and our fundamental bottom line happened.
Yeah, no, it was definitely covered by places like The Atlantic and Business Insider and a couple others published the case study as well.
That had to make you feel really great.
It did, yeah. I wish that I wasn't known as the restaurant menu expert not to be named in the articles, but, you know, that's contract negotiation for you.
Oh, wow. So you're actually not even mentioned in the articles.
No, never.
So you're kind of like an information architecture ninja, right? You just get into the place and you do the job and then you fly out and no one ever knows your name.
Yep. Always behind the clipboard.
Well, that's all right. I mean, certainly it's unfortunate because I'm sure the articles pigeonhole you, but the idea though that you can kind of flip big IA switches, flip little IA switches, and transform an entire supply chain is pretty significant.
Yeah, and to be honest, it wouldn't even be my name that I'd be wishing for the article to mention. It would be information architecture in general. I did, one of them said the word taxonomy, and I almost fell over. So that was pretty good.
That's a word that they've been using at work a lot lately, and I get a little bit of an Inigo Montoya moment sometimes when people use taxonomy, you know. You keep using that word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
Yeah, no, taxonomies get used a lot to mean navigation systems on websites, which, you know, I mean, taxonomy is just a classification system of something. So the manifestation of a navigation menu could be classified as a taxonomy, but it's sort of like the thought that you can go across the street and look at a building and really understand it from an architectural standpoint. You might see the facade, you can see what the building looks like on the outside, but you're not actually looking at how it's constructed. So to say that you can even see a taxonomy is kind of flawed.
This episode of Hansel Minutes is brought to you by Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're building a mobile app and you're searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. The Braintree V.0 SDK makes it easy to offer multiple mobile payment types, so you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, credit cards, and more, all with a single integration. One small snippet of code and you're set up in less than 10 minutes. If you don't have time, you can give them a call. They'll even handle the integration for you and walk you through it. The SDK supports 7 languages: .NET, Node, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. Elegant code, clear documentation. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/Hanselman. That's braintreepayments.com/Hanselman. How many, and this might be a wrong question, but I suppose in information architecture, there are no wrong questions, but how many people leap into IA as a career with really no background, no business doing it? They just think that they're clever and they talk their way into being an information architect, as opposed to looking at it from the science perspective.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I definitely wouldn't classify it as a science. And I think by your definition, a lot of people probably do. But I think that there's probably a lot of people like that in any industry. You know, I could ask you the same thing about software development.
Well, I've been coasting on charm for almost 20 years now. So
join the club.
Probably shouldn't have. The reason I ask is that you've got this great article on your blog at abbytheia.com called "So You Want to Be an Information Architect?" And you talk about these kind of prototypical emails that show up where it's like, you know, I have this job and it's not really working out the way I planned. I'm hearing about information architecture, and that seems like a job I should do. And you kind of go through the motivations for why one would do this. And all of them seem like great motivations, but you tear them down one by one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in order to really become an information architect, you have to be ready, you know, back to that restaurant example, you have to be ready to be behind the scenes, and you also have to be ready to have a job where it is your sole purpose to make other people agree on language and structure, which generally means leaving your opinions at the door and not bringing them into the boardroom, even if you think that that's going to make you look really smart. And I think that a lot of people struggle with that understanding when they first hear the term because of, I guess, the starchitect mentality that physical architecture has taken on, where, you know, oh, I'm gonna be the head designer on a large building. That's what an architect is. And in reality, you know, I think 98% of architects are not doing that kind of work. They're doing the work that no one ever knows about. And it's really important work because it's how the structures we dwell in don't fall on our heads. You know, but it's not the most glamorous of circumstances. So I do feel the need to kind of tell people that when they email me, that if that's your motivation to like make more money and be really well known, then like you're barking up the wrong tree for sure.
Interesting. So it isn't as much coming in and saying, "All right, I'm here. Abby is here, and I have a plan," and then you impose that plan. You really are coming there. There's an amount of consensus building.
Yeah. No, and agreement is the medium that I work in the most because, you know, back to the idea that there is no one right way. I mean, if you look at something as simple as a grocery store website classifying their produce, right? We could have an argument for 12 minutes about how Linnaean taxonomy puts tomatoes and zucchinis as fruit, but we're not going to classify them that way on a grocery store website because nobody would be able to find the dang things. So I find that having, you know, the smarts to understand what you think you understand about the world is actually not enough when it comes to information architecture. You need to be the one that's willing to set all that aside and listen to people's mental models get voiced and then be the one that can compare those and draw out the distinctions and say, okay, when you say this word, this person over here does not hear the same thing that you're hearing. They hear this completely different concept. So let's talk it out. And I happen to be good at that particular thing.
That must be really difficult for people who are large businesses. I imagine you going into said food place with the menu, talking to some older, you know, I've been in this business for 50 years and this is how we've always done it type of an individual who's now being told that the way that they categorize things isn't working and here's the science behind it. You don't know anything about their business, right? They grew up in their business. Maybe their mom and dad gave them the business. And then you have to come together. And then at the end, everyone has to agree and be happy.
Yeah. That's the most difficult part of my job, I would say, is dealing with the emotions behind people letting go of their one way of doing things and moving towards a new way. It seems really simple, but it's actually not. People go through like all of the defined stages of grief when it comes to letting go of their way of organizing things, in my experience.
Mm-hmm. In your So You Want to Be an Information Architect blog, one of your motivations says, you want to be an information architect because you're in love with the idea of spreading clarity and understanding. Somehow I just thought that you would just kind of like, I'm here to spread.
Oh, I'm such a hippie sometimes. Yeah. Totally.
No, but you know, it's not quite that glamorous.
No, it's not. I mean, spreading clarity and understanding, I don't think has ever been glamorous for any person who's ever tried it. You know, it's a pretty thankless job, but it's mm-hmm. also really necessary. I mean, I think that having bold dreams for what one can accomplish in the world is important. And mine would be that I want to make the world a clearer place. But I also understand that I'm only ever going to be a very small part of doing that. So that's why I spend so much time talking to other people about information architecture. So if we have names mm-hmm. for these things, we can learn more about them. And I think that IA is one of those things that a lot of people don't have a name for. They're sort of like, well, it's really good looking and it meets all of our business goals and it's still not really doing the thing it's supposed to do. It still doesn't make sense to our users. And mm-hmm. I think that with words, we can have conversations about things like that.
So you modestly said that you would be a small part of that and you can't really make the world a better place, but you do have a thing you're working on right now called World IA Day. that people can see at worldiaday.org.
Yeah, World IA Day has been an amazing experience for me to understand that there are a ton of people in this world that really do believe in those words and want to further them in their local communities. So World IA Day is sponsored by the Information Architecture Institute, which I'm currently the president of. And we started World IA Day 5 years ago, at which point we had 14 locations in 14 countries. Now, in 2016, we are looking at 73 locations in 39 countries across 6 continents. So all we got left now is Antarctica. So if there's any information architect enthusiasts listening from Antarctica, please let me know. I would love to talk to you about 2017.
Yeah, I'm looking at this here, Call for Cities, the one that's it's now closed. And anytime I hear that there's something going on, I look for Portland, where I live. And I'm like, well, surely there won't be an IA Day in Portland. And then boom, there we are.
Portland's been great. We've had one in Portland for the last 4 years. It's one of our most beloved events.
Ah, okay. Well, then Portland is as far as I'm concerned, is the central location of this event.
Yeah, well, this is obviously.
Great, I'm going to check that out. And then you've got a book that is really got a great title. It's called How to Make Sense of Any Mess.
Yep. As of last November, I considered myself an author. So that was pretty exciting.
Was it hard, as you've been doing this forever, right? You've been an information architect for a long time. Was it hard to organize the information in a book? Was that like, did you just do your job and it was fine and the book just came together, or was it more difficult?
It was very, very difficult. Yeah, it was probably the most meta IA task that I have assigned myself in my career. It definitely did not just come together. It went through many, many revisions. It did not have that particular name until pretty late in the game, actually.
Really?
The story of the name was that I was avoiding the words table of contents, and the chapters were all very actionable. We have identify the mess, state your intent, face reality, and they were all like steps of this process. And so when I was naming the process, I named it How to Make Sense of Any Mess, and I used that as the header instead of saying table of contents. And I was showing it to a good friend of mine, Carl Collins, and he famously ripped the cover of the book off and was like, this is the name of the book. And so I went with it, and I'm really glad I did, because it's the kind of name that people stop you in an airport and ask, like, what's that book about? Which I never would have expected on a book, on something that I, you know, was starting to consider to be a pretty dry topic.
Yeah, cover design definitely matters. And I don't mean to gush. I don't usually gush with guests. But not only is the title good, but when you flip it over, as a programmer, I like, because you have the 7 steps. You have these words in red. So it's like identify the mess, where identify is in red. State your intent. Like, it's systematic. And without even opening the book, you're like, wait a second, this is actually like a planned, organized, this isn't some foo-foo, you know, way of thinking about the world. This is like, here is a way to think. This works for us. You should get involved. It's very actionable. It's a very verb. You know what I mean?
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I think a big part of information architecture is breaking the world into nouns and verbs and the relationship that they have to each other. So the back cover design definitely reflects that methodology as well.
Yeah. And it's also got like 42 5-star reviews, so you're doing pretty well.
I have been incredibly proud to see the movement since the book came out. It's been great.
One of the other things that I was surprised as I started researching information architecture is not only to find people like Jesse James Garrett, who I thought of as being a UX person, but also a person named Richard Saul Wurman.
Oh, yeah, Ricky. He's one of my heroes.
So I think about things like, you know, like there's this like legendary character who like created, and then, you know, oh, Ricky. I assume you have him on speed dial. He's in your favorites.
I love nicknames for people, and that is the one that I've associated with him for the longest. Yeah, I think Richard Saul Wurman is absolutely by far number one hero of my career. Mm-hmm. He just has this way of writing about things and talking about things that is no nonsense, completely to the heart of the point. And he really cares about making the world clearer. And I find that there's not a lot of people that have that as their sole intention. And I feel like I've copied that from him for sure.
Mm-hmm. And he's been doing IA since the early 70s.
Yeah, he's actually the one who coined the term for the first time at a conference for physical architects, which is what his background and training is in. So he was the one mm-hmm. that introduced the world of physical architecture into the world of graphic design, and using the term information architect to describe the people that would wrangle these kinds of, battles of misinformation. A book that he wrote in, I think, the late 80s, early 90s, called Information Anxiety is one of my favorites. I would definitely recommend for anybody out there to pick a copy of that up.
And for people who may be listening and thinking that we're just throwing cool names out, I point out not only did Jesse James Garrett do the term Ajax, but Richard Saul Wurman also created the TED conference. So you may be familiar with that if you're not familiar with all of his other work.
Yes, that is one of his greatest calling cards.
That'd be pretty slick to be able to do something like that, if you can just say, oh yeah, you ever heard of IA? Well, no. Well, what about TED? Oh, TED, you're the TED.
I do use that a lot, actually, to lend credibility to the term, because people like to ask, where did it come from? When did it start? And I think it's really interesting, because I think a lot of people assume that it was invented, sometime in the late 90s because of web design, but not so much.
And interestingly, if you look at it, it's an extremely organized website with a large group of a large corpus that one has to find the way around. And I've never had any problem finding my way around there.
Yep.
The other thing that I wanted to ask you about is that you've got a on your blog on Abby the IA, there was this one post, I think it was earlier this year, that was called "This Is the Work."
Mm. That's one of my favorites. I wrote that for my students. Yeah.
Okay, I'm glad. Would you share that with share what that's about with me?
Yeah, I think that especially when you get into the academic environment, that idea of right and wrong and correct and incorrect and there being one right way really comes pretty clear. I mean, students, especially students who are trying to work their way through an immense amount of work in a graduate degree program in their final year, which is what my job is to take them through that final semester of their final year, they can get really overwhelmed with this idea of having conversations about semantics and structure with themselves. They can think that it's a waste of time. They can think that they're kind of circling the bowl a little bit more than they should be. But I find that time and time again, what's really happening is procrastination and distraction from getting real about those topics is what is holding them back. So I encourage my students to sit down and put away the computer, get out a piece of paper, and think about the words. And that can be really difficult for them to understand that, like, that's not an act of post-it theater, right? That's not like a design theatrics exercise that we're having you do so you look like a designer. It's actually where the work happens. The work does not happen in making, wireframes for the final thing. That's some of the work, but if you don't do that upfront piece to understand what it is you're making before you decide how to make it, you can get yourself into a pretty big pickle.
I think that's a really good reminder to everyone. I mean, I have been over the last 20 years in front of giant whiteboards with a stack of post-it notes and a problem and a room full of people, and had in a number of instances them say that wasn't useful, what we were doing right there.
That's when I
felt the most useful. Like we're really getting into it right now. Like we've been, I like what you said, post-it note theater, although that's going to make me wonder if I'm really doing it right in the future. But it does feel like the work. Like, I feel like that's like, aren't we all agreeing? Aren't we moving towards agreement? Aren't we getting in that general direction right now?
Well, a lot of times I think when those objections come up, it's because their mental model of whatever is being discussed is so far off from the model being drawn on the post-it notes or on the whiteboard that they're not yet comfortable with this idea that they might not be part of the solution. They might be part of the problem. Oh.
So you may have touched on the moment where they felt like they were being left behind.
Exactly. Like going back to that person who has had the business and this is the way we've already always done things. I mean, that's the person who stands up in the meeting when I'm at the whiteboard myself and is like, I don't know why we're wasting our time on this particular step when we could just be going back to our desks and doing our job. We hired you. You're the expert. Figure it out. And I'm like, okay, that's not what's happening right here. Like what we're working on is agreement. We're not working on, my drawing skills at this whiteboard. Like that's counter to the point.
The best part about that blog post is the where you talk about what words do you not want used to describe your work. You basically force people to lean in and face the uncomfortable. There is criticism about the work, or people may disagree with your work. So let's just talk about that right now. Like, what are the words that you don't want people saying?
Yeah, and sometimes those are things that can be avoided. Other times you struggle to come up with what those words are, and that tells you that maybe the fear is much bigger in your head than it is in reality. And I think that getting people to have conversations in simple terms, like adjectives, you know, it's just like, let's just put out some adjectives right now. What would be the adjectives you'd be proud for your work to be described as? And then what are the opposites of those things? And does the opposite make you less proud, or is it something that you should actually just accommodate for? I've had students have a lot of breakthroughs through activities like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate you chatting with me today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This is great.
So people can check out Abby at ABBYVIA, Abby VIA, and you can look at her book and her blog and her talks and videos and all things information architecture, and also check out the Information Architecture Institute and go and Google for World IA Day. It's at worldiaday.org. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.